This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Is it just me, or do things in Washington seem to be moving at a faster clip than we can keep up with? At the top of the list of things that are moving quickly is President Trump's executive order on immigration. On Thursday evening, a three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court's decision to halt the executive order. But that doesn't mean the president's team has stopped the fight. A little later, we'll be talking about that executive order. But first, on Tuesday of this week, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma introduced the Protect Funding for Women's Healthcare Act, and he joined Tony to discuss how that bill would redirect taxpayer funds away from Planned Parenthood.
Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, always good to be with you. Thanks for what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate it. It's good to talk to you again. It was good seeing you last week. Let's talk about this, and then I want to talk a little bit about the confirmations, because that's pretty hot right now. You have joined with others, the president, well, let me go back. First, the president leaving town, one of his last acts, the former president, was saying that states could not defund Planned Parenthood in their federal funds that come into their state. You're addressing that, and you're basically helping put this money in places where it will legitimately help women.
You're right. There's really two different directions for Planned Parenthood that are rolling right now. One is something we'll try to do through the reconciliation process when we do the Obamacare repeal and replace, and that is taking away the Medicaid funds and saying this is the largest provider of abortions in the country. This is an entity that has been selling baby body parts, and we do not believe those funds should go through from the federal side. Then there's a separate, and we believe, as you mentioned before, those dollars should go to the federally qualified health clinics. There are many more of those. Planned Parenthood always says we take care of women's health. They're really a location to get abortion advice, and then they do screening, but not actually medical care. They're just the screenings all around the country. Then there are places called the federally qualified health clinics that are scattered around the country. There are thousands of them. For instance, in my state in Oklahoma, there are five Planned Parenthood locations, but there are 65 locations that are these federally qualified health centers. Those locations don't do screenings. They actually do the health care. They do the testing. The physicians are actually there. It's a completely different level of medical care. We want to get those dollars rather than to a location that provides abortions and does screenings to places that actually provide women's health care and don't do just the screening, actually do the testing, actually do the health care. We think it's a more efficient use of federal dollars, and it removes the stigma of those dollars going to Planned Parenthood. That's one part of it. The other part of it is trying to get the power back to the states to be able to make decisions on where their dollars go and where individuals can go. So that's a separate, what's called a Congressional Review Act. That is also a vote that we'll be able to take, hopefully, in the weeks ahead. But that gives states back the authority that the Obama administration took away from them to make decisions on health care dollars in their states.
Let me ask you a question on something that's really always kind of bothered me. When you've got an organization like Planned Parenthood that gets roughly a $500 million a year from taxpayers. But then in the last election, and I don't have the total tally in front of me, but I know it was several million dollars, tens of millions, that they spent on this election. You know, it would seem to me that an organization, any entity, regardless left or right, that receives government money, that somehow there seems to be a conflict of interest for them to be able to engage in direct election politics. And I know it's a different entity, but it's still under the same umbrella.
Right. And that's where they separate the monies out. Well, they will say, we don't use any of our federal funds for abortion, and we don't use any of our federal funds for lobbying. But obviously, those dollars that come into them from grants, that dollars that come into them through Medicaid, those provide the resources and the facilities and the staffing. So all of the dollars that they can use for major lobbying efforts, because that money is clearly fungible. But they are a major player on the left side. And you can see the women's march that happened the day after inauguration. They were a major, Planned Parenthood was a major player in that march, then protesting Donald Trump. They're a major player in donating to a lot of liberal causes because they want to be able to keep the voice out there. That's the constant drumbeat they have, that they're all about women's health. But they're really only providing some basic screening and in abortion. And there's a lot more to women's health than that.
Yeah, without question. James Langford, Senator, Oklahoma, my guest. All right, Senator, let's talk a little bit about confirmations. Getting a little testy up there, is it not, on Capitol Hill?
It is. It's actually very sad. The Democrats continue to force every vote into the longest time period possible instead of allowing a new president to be able to put the staff together that he wants to be able to put together. That's always been the privilege of every president. This president now, Donald Trump, is now the longest process to put his cabinet together since George Washington. And that may sound extreme, but when we were coming together as a nation and they were trying to figure out how they were going to do advice and consent, it took a long time to get that first cabinet together. No other cabinet has taken as long to put together since George Washington as Donald Trump's cabinet is.
Well, they were also trying to get to Washington. Statement. They were trying to get to Washington in horse and buggy, too, so it took a little longer.
Yeah, slightly different structure at that point, but it's very sad. This goes back to how President Obama was treated, how even President Bush and President Clinton was treated. By this point in their presidency, President Clinton and President Obama had their entire cabinet together with very few exceptions. We're now through five people for President Trump, and they continue to be able to block and slow down as often as they can, and we're just going to work through the process to be able to get people checked off and done.
All right, well, we're going to keep watching it. Senator Langford, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be able to do it.
You can find more on Senator Langford and the Protect Funding for Women's Healthcare Act when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at the court's opposition to the travel pause.
What will Donald do during his first 100 days in office? Family Research Council has laid out a conservative playbook for the president-elect to follow in order to repair some of the damage done by the Obama administration's liberal elite special interests. In a timely panel discussion, policy experts lay out a game plan of actions that the Trump administration can take in its first 100 days. Visit frc.org/first100 to view this policy discussion.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. Even though the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals didn't hand down their ruling on President Trump's travel pause until Thursday, Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana had an idea the court would oppose the president, and he joined FRC President Tony Perkins on Wednesday to discuss the travel pause.
Mike, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. Great to talk with you.
Let's start first with those that are saying this is unconstitutional for the president to take this action.
Well, clearly they're wrong, and you know my background is in constitutional law, so for almost 20 years I was in federal courts litigating cases just like this, and it's very clear that Article 2 of the Constitution allows the president of the United States the inherent foreign affairs and national security powers. And more specifically, it's been widely reported and noted over the last several days that more than 60 years ago, the Congress expressly delegated this particular discretionary authority to the president. It's 8 U.S.C. Section 1182. It's been cited everywhere. And it says, as you know, that whenever the president, here's the language, quote, finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interest of the U.S., then he has the authority to suspend the entry of those aliens. That's all that's happened here. It's happened many times. In fact, six of the last seven presidents have done this, and it shouldn't be controversial at all.
Now, let's talk about another aspect of this. When the Bill of Rights was adopted by the first Congress, was there a notion or an idea that these constitutional rights, these Bill of Rights, would apply to those who are not American citizens?
Of course not. There are no constitutional rights regarding the application for admission as a citizen to our country or as an immigrant, because it's the sovereign prerogative of the government to deny admission on whatever grounds that the government sees fit, really. And this is case law from the U.S. Supreme Court that goes back decades. So, you know, it's interesting that the federal judge that struck this down in the trial court, in the district court there, he didn't cite a single statute to support his argument, or certainly no provision of the Constitution that was allegedly violated, because there isn't one, you know. And I think that's why, ultimately, Tony, this is going to prevail. I expect certainly it will go to the Supreme Court on what will likely be a rocket docket, as we say, and I think they're going to find that this is clearly within the authority of the president to do.
How quickly, Mike Johnson, might this appear before the nation's highest court?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it is likely to be weeks as opposed to months. I think that the court recognizes the urgency of the matter, and I think that they'll take it up in short order. You know, the Ninth Circuit could issue their opinion at any time, the three-judge panel. And I did think that was interesting as well. I mean, everyone was able to see that play out on live television if they watched it, and the transcripts are there. And I thought it was interesting that Judge Richard Clifton on the panel noted that, you know, really the argument that this is about a Muslim ban just simply isn't accurate. And he said that, you know, he noted the vast majority of Muslims are unaffected. There's more than about 40 countries that are Muslim majority that are not included in the executive order. So it's really a ridiculous argument for them to say that this is a target to all Muslims.
Yeah, what this is, it's targeting seven countries that have track records of radical Islamic terrorists coming from those countries. So it's not, with the exception of one country, this is not a permanent ban. It's temporary. And it's simply to allow a vetting process to be put in place to ensure that those coming into our country do not intend to do us harm.
It's a matter of common sense to most Americans. I mean, we look at this and we understand that it's just simple logic. You should carefully review persons who are entering your country if they're coming from areas known to be terrorist strongholds, and that's exactly what we have. And by the way, as has also been widely noted, these seven nations were not selected by Donald Trump. I mean, this was the previous administration, the previous Congress, that singled out these seven countries. And so he's merely, again, just following common sense and doing what is right by the American people. The first job, the most important job of the President of the United States, is to protect the citizenry, and that's what he's doing with this order.
Mike, I know you're a student of the Bible. There are some kind of left-leaning evangelicals, not all left-leaning, some are not necessarily liberal, but I think misapplying the scripture in two places, one suggesting that the government has to allow people into this country because of the biblical teaching of taking in the stranger. First, I think it's a misapplication because that's to the church. It's not to the government. But secondly, there are clear provisions in scripture that would make it a priority to care for your own well-being and the protection of your citizens before you allow others in.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I remember an old seminar that you taught many years ago when I was coming out of law school. I sat under you, and you talked about the spheres of authority from a biblical perspective. And, you know, clearly the sphere of authority that God has granted and ordained for civil government is different from that of the church and of, you know, Christians in general. And the admonitions of Scripture, I think they are citing out of context. What the church aims to do, what we aim to do as individuals, is not the same instruction to the civil government, whose first charge, as we said, is to maintain order and the protection and safety of the people. And so I do think they're conflating that. You know, I've been reminded a couple of times over the last couple of days, just remembering about Nehemiah, one of our favorite stories that you and I talk about all the time, we cite and Bible studies and all that. You know, Nehemiah built the wall, right? There was a purpose to it. It was to protect against those who sought to do the nation of Israel harm. And clearly, there are dangerous persons and terrorists all across the world, certainly in these seven nations, who we know are in a literal sense, hell-bent on doing us harm. And I think it's right for us to protect our families and our communities, and this is one way to do it.
Yeah, in fact, I mentioned Nehemiah this morning, chapter 7, where after he had built the wall and put the gates in, he instructed the guards not to open the gates until the sun was hot, so they knew exactly who was coming in, and they could keep those out who intended to do them harm. And so you cannot have a nation unless you can control who comes into that nation, and you determine whether or not they want to be a part of your society, or they want to tear that society apart. And that's what's unique about America, is that we do welcome people here who want to be a part of the American family, so to speak, but we're under no obligation. And this is really what gets me, Mike, is that there are some in this country that literally believe we should allow anybody and everybody into this country, even those who come from places with clear track records of trying to kill, yes, kill Americans and those who embrace democracy.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, the data is on the side of common sense and logic and the president's executive order. Because when you look at this and you look at the reason why was this necessary, you know, the liberals say, why did the president have to come out and do this? Well, look, it was just September, this past fall, the inspector general of the Department of Homeland Security issued his report. He said somewhere between 800 and 1,800 individuals were quote, accidentally granted citizenship. We know that there's not been a top-down interagency or outside review of the previous administration's vetting process changes and all that in recent at least in the last year, and since this refugee crisis began from Syria and elsewhere. So we know that there are dangerous people who are mixed into these crowds, and we have an obligation to find them and determine who they are. This pause makes sense. It is good for the country, and I think the court's going to uphold it.
Well, I certainly think, Mike, that if there were to be a terrorist attack in this country again, and it was someone who came from one of these seven countries, the left would be screaming to hold the president accountable. And he has done exactly what he said he was going to do. He's going to put America first, and he was going to protect Americans, which I think is job number one for the president of the United States.
That's right, and he's doing that job well. And if the courts will do their job and apply the statutes, apply the Constitution here, he'll be allowed to do that, and we certainly pray that happens.
You can find out more about Representative Mike Johnson when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Marriages everywhere are in crisis. The divorce rate is sky high. What can turn things around? The key lies in what God has bestowed on mankind, incarnational attachment. This in turn leads to the transforming power of being emotionally present in marriage. In a profound lecture by Dr. Jesse Gill, discover more about embracing God's design for attachment for marriage and our Christian faith in ways that bring transformation and growth. Visit frc.org/events to view this lecture and many more.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Last weekend, the New England Patriots won the NFL championship, but it's what happened during the television timeouts that caught many people's attention. How will corporate America walk that fine line between what half of America wants and what the other half doesn't want? CEO of Breitbart News, Larry Soloff, joined Tony on Tuesday.
Larry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. How you doing today?
I'm good. You know, the commercials in the Super Bowls are usually humorous. They're always often talked about. A lot of political messages in this year's ads during the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. I think what we're seeing here needs, you know, some broader context, which is that the liberals are right now, they've been shut out at the ballot box. They don't have control in Washington, so they find themselves politically stymied. They're losing increasingly their monopoly on media and messaging. And that's happening because of outlets like yours, because of Breitbart, because of a number of other ways that now conservatives can get their message out there and around the mainstream media. And they're beginning to lose control on campuses as well. And as they are losing control, they're turning to a new form or a new front in this culture war, which is enlisting corporations. And they're doing it in a number of ways. Either corporations are taking active stances, they're either funding, as you mentioned, the opposition to the travel pause, or they are coming out and messaging directly. We saw, how many of us just wanted to watch a football game and not be inundated with political messages? But that's what we got in the advertising on the Super Bowl. And the ones that stand out in my mind the most are the Budweiser commercial, where you had ostensibly, you know, Americans picking on an immigrant and being nasty to an immigrant. And the 84 Lumber ad, which was basically a long trek, up through I guess, you know, Central America and Mexico to arrive ultimately at a border wall and, you know, get into the country. I mean, these are outright political statements. And the other way that it's happening,
everybody was kind of concerned that the halftime was going to be the political message that we were going to have to be subjected to. But in fact, it was the ads that most people look to for a little humor. And you're actually right. They were these very not so subtle political messages countering the policy prescriptions that Donald Trump was elected on, I should add, but is also following through on as president.
Yeah, and the majority of Americans, you know, support, you know, President Trump's position. The other way that now the left is enlisting, and we've talked about this before, Tony, is enlisting corporate America, is in this idea of boycotting anyone who aligns with the Trump administration or supports the Trump administration's policies. And again, that's the majority of Americans.
Yeah,
that's
isn't
what
that
corporations aren't getting.
Larry, isn't that kind of, for corporate America, isn't that like playing with fire? I mean, that's a little risky when they're pushing these boycotts and they're in, you know, teaming up with people and suggesting they shouldn't go here or shouldn't do this. For instance, what they did to North Carolina. When you have, as you pointed out, a majority of Americans who voted sided with Donald Trump, could this not backfire on them?
It will backfire if we stand firm and we make it backfire. It's up to us, frankly. It's up to us to tell them it's not okay, and we can do that, you know, literally, but we can also, you know, tell them with our pocketbooks.
Right. And that's key.
That's
absolutely critical when you talk about our pocketbooks. We often talk here about the Second Vote, which is actually an app which lets you know where these corporate giants stand on so many fundamental issues. But, Larry, so a lot of you guys at Breitbart have actually come face-to-face with this with Kellogg.
Absolutely. Kellogg's boycotted us, stopped advertising on us. There have been a number of other advertisers that have stopped advertising on Breitbart. They don't care that we're more voices, not less. They don't care that we're free speech. They don't care. What they care is that we're not expressing the politically correct, toe the line of the left viewpoint. And what's interesting, Tony, and you're right, this could backfire, but they are now so emboldened or alternatively desperate that they're not trying to hide their agendas anymore. And the corporate boardrooms are coming out and exposing their actual politics. And it's a very, very interesting time. And I think we really need to add to the list of academia, the mainstream media, you know, corporate America as increasingly in the hands of the liberals.
Let me ask you this, Larry. Do you think that you talked about the corporate boardrooms. Are they making these decisions proactively? Or are they being pushed by the left with threat of boycotts against them and trying to push them into this battle? Because as you pointed out, the liberals, these radicals have lost government, control of government, Barack Obama, and they no longer have the pen and the phone. They're losing at the college level, the universities across America. They're certainly losing because of the alternative media. So are they putting the squeeze on these corporate boardrooms, or are they willingly doing this?
That's a great question, Tony. I'd really love to know the answer to that, and I'm not going to pretend to have the insight because I'm not sitting in those boardrooms. What I can tell you is that the left is exceedingly active in constantly placing phone calls, writing, berating corporations that, you know, really not even taking a conservative position, but not adopting a leftist orthodoxy is enough to earn their ire. And, you know, these boardrooms seem to be responding. I also think that in some cases, the people in the boardrooms are out of touch with the average American, live on the coast, don't have a high regard for quote-unquote flyover country, and are living in a bubble. and that leads them to make decisions which alienate the majority of the American people.
Are we at, Larry, a turning point with the election of Donald Trump and the, I would describe it as almost the emboldening of the average American to now speak up? Are we at a tipping point where we could see the country kind of move back to clearly right-of-center policies?
I think the dirty secret, so to speak, has been that we are always and have been a center-right country. And that has been, you know, we have been portrayed as otherwise by media, academics, and a lot of politicians, certainly the Democratic Party and liberal politicians. But I do think that we should feel emboldened by our victory and take, you know, a lot of courage and gain a lot of strength and be willing to, you know, make our voices heard now more than ever before.
Larry, quickly, we're almost out of time. Are you still kind of locked into this kind of battle with Kellogg? And if so, how can our listeners help?
Well, okay. Well, I appreciate your asking. Yes, we're still locked in the battle with Kellogg. We, in response to Kellogg's very public statement denouncing us and our 45 million, that's right, 45 million monthly visitors, a sizable part of this country, and one that you would think corporations would not be willing to so easily insult, and yet they seem willing to be, to do so. You know, sign our petition. You can find it online. And do everything you can to support the advertisers that support us. And let the advertisers who are boycotting us, and it's much more than Kellogg, let them know that it's not okay with you. Because
yeah.
The left is letting them know, from their side, their opinion. So it's up to us to make our voices heard too.
If you missed any of today's program, you can find a link to it by heading over to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.